they're taking the hydrogen that was normally being dumped over and then mixing it with the carbon dioxide from the scrubbers. And what they're doing is you're taking the hydrogen air and the oxygen from the carbon dioxide, and they're mixing that together and they're getting water again. And then the leftover on that is the carbon. So they get rid of the carbon, but they, now at least they have water. And then they're able to separate this again and get more oxygen and water. So it's not 100% system, but it's quite effective. I mean, you know, it's almost like a biosphere deck. Back to you, WSUS. I can see the advantage of bringing up water, because I get the impression that water, H2O, the oxygen is in a very compact form when it's in liquid water. And then by hydrolysis, you subtract you separate the hydrogen and the oxygen, and you use the oxygen. Okay, now, and you think that the amount of oxygen they breathe is equal to 1 liter of water per day. I did a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation, and something's wrong here, Paul. Each breath that you take is approximately 1 liter of air. And 1 liter of air, 1,000 liters of air is going to be 1 cubic meter of air. 1 cubic meter of air is 2.7 pounds. So when you take in 1,000 breaths, the total mass of air you have breathed is 2.7 pounds of air. Let me drop. 1 liter of water weighs 2 pounds. So even if all of the water can be converted to oxygen, and that's the heaviest part of it, by the way. So if all the water can be converted to oxygen, 1 liter of water is going to give you less than 2 pounds of oxygen. 2 pounds of oxygen, when it's in gaseous form, is roughly 1 cubic meter. 1 cubic meter is 1,000 liters. 1,000 liters is 1,000 breaths. I know in 24 hours I breathe a lot more than 1,000 breaths. So something's wrong there. It may be it's still a good process, but I guarantee a human being is using more than 1 liter's worth of oxygen, 1 liter of water worth of oxygen per day. You see where I'm going with that one, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's really like 1/3 of that thick. You gotta remember that it's the same thing as on Earth. They've got nitrogen up there, and it's the same proportion, so 14.7 pounds per square inch floating around that station. And the nitrogen is like 2/3 of it. The oxygen is really 1/3. So it's really, that's how they do that.
Okay, what we breathe, I think, is like 23% oxygen and 80-some-odd% nitrogen. So that makes a 5-to-1 ratio improvement. Still, and by the way, are you telling me the space station runs at 14.7 pounds? I thought the space shuttle runs at something like 5 or 10 pounds. I thought it runs at a lower pressure than standard atmosphere. Maybe the shuttle, I know the spacesuit runs at around 5 pounds, pure oxygen. So I guess you're telling me the space station and the space shuttle both run at 14.7, normal pressure. Wow. And did Mir also run at normal pressure? WS2N, K2LIW, and the TechNet?
I think Mir was 10 pounds. Similar to what the Quest is, but not sure about me. I'm positive about the 14.7, about the atmosphere inside that space station. And it's the same as on Earth. That's why I have the nitrogen in there as well. But let's say you're going to do a spacewalk. You go on what they call a campout now. You go into the Quest lab, a pretty big module, and your two astronauts go in there, and they'll sleep overnight, and they'll be sleeping in 10 pounds per square inch and oxygen. And they could come back, you know, and eat breakfast in the morning with the crew, but their blood has already gotten rid of all the nitrogen from their system. It used to involve a bigger process. So then now they don't have the problems. They used to have to purge all the nitrogen out the old-fashioned way. Now they just sleep in there overnight under 10 pounds, and then they go to their spaces The original space suits Apollo and all was 5 pounds. I think they've dropped them down around 3.5 or 4 or something, but actually the lower pressure inside the space suit makes it easy to work, to move your arms, especially your hands. You know, it's quite pressurized in a, 3 or 4 pounds. It doesn't sound much, doesn't sound like much, but you try to work outside of a space station and maneuvering your hands for hours on end, and it, they say it's very difficult. The lower the pressure, the better it is, and of course, pure oxygen, because you need that volume of oxygen to survive.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And I guess when you live for months at a time on the meter at 10 pounds a square inch, I guess there was a small disadvantage, a little bit like living at the high altitude on a mountain. Although I presume Mir ran a higher oxygen to nitrogen content than the normal sea level content. Is that true? So the total volume of oxygen that you breathe was still the same, even when you were in Mir. So did Mir run a slightly richer oxygen mixture pool, WS2N, K2LAW?
I know it was different. I don't know the numbers, though, so I don't want to quote on the numbers. Space shuttle itself used to be, they used to be around 10 pounds, and then they changed over to 14.7 pounds final month. And then during a regular flight, let's say a space lab flight or something, and then if they were going to do a space walk, they would drop the whole system down to 10, the whole, space shuttle down to 10 pounds, more or less all oxygen. Now with the space station, you've got the Quest lab up there, Quest docking, or what do they call it? It's a separate module where right before you go out and you do a spacewalk. And the Russians have one on their side as well. But it's incredible. Now, with the making up the oxygen, too, I wanted to bring up before, it's no problem because the solar panels are delivering 90 kilowatts of power. So they have plenty of power to use for electrolysis. I didn't want to mention that before. But, and I'm about to check on the numbers on Mir. But nowhere near as comfortable as the space station. Space station, you have as much room in the space station as the inside of a 747 type you can.
Now, one last thing that's bothering me, Paul, and that is when you do electrolysis of water and you get the oxygen and hydrogen out of it, and the oxygen you store and use for human consumption, and I think you said the hydrogen is just dumped overboard. I'd like to believe there's some way of bottling the hydrogen, combining it with something else, and it becomes a thrusting fuel, because there is a continuous need for thrusting on the International Space Station in order to maintain orbit. I'm amazed somebody hasn't considered some magic substance they bring up. You combine it with the hydrogen, and you now got a thrusting fuel. Yeah, I guess in the case of the original liquid rocket launch of the space shuttle, you used oxygen and hydrogen. So if you're willing to sacrifice some of the oxygen with the hydrogen, you've got a thrusting capability. But the oxygen is so valuable, you want to keep it for the human beings. What if there's something else that could combine with the hydrogen that they brought up and now make a thrusting fuel out of it, as opposed to just dumping it? To take that valuable substance and just dump it overboard seems a little bit wasteful. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, that's why I got this new system up there a couple of years ago. And I'm trying to think what they call that thing. But yeah, it was, they take the hydrogen and they mix the hydrogen with the scrubbers, with the carbon dioxide. And by doing that, I think you have just carbon left over. So, you are now saving that hydrogen. And it was something called a saboteur reactor. I guess he was the guy that invented this thing. And that's what they're using. So you take the carbon dioxide, you mix it with the hydrogen that was left over from the electrolysis, and that converts back to water. And now you got the only thing left is carbon. I guess you get rid of that now. That's it. I mean, they're going to use the saboteur reactor system eventually when they go to Mars. Mars has a lot of carbon dioxide on the planet. And they're going to mix the two, and they're going to be able to do the same thing there. And then with a little different chemical reaction, I think they're going to wind up with methane on Mars, and they'll have a way to manufacture fuel, and they'll be able to use that fuel for everything on Mars, maybe put it into a spacecraft and launch yourself the heck out of there. but that's what they use now on the space station. So it's almost like a closed system. Back to you, Dick.
Question, Dick. Go ahead, John. T2WGB. Maybe Paul knows. Didn't they use hydrogen peroxide at one time?
For what? Sounds like they use that for hydrogen perchloride or something, I think was it. And by the way, John, you don't want to get started with this about the oxygen, I think, a week or so ago. So I went down this road researching all this stuff. Back to you, John.
Well, Paul, I believe they used hydrogen peroxide in the thrusters. Maybe it was on one of the older craft, but I thought that was something they could do with the hydrogen instead of jettisoning it.
Yeah, it was used as fuel, hydrogen peroxide. Now they use hydrogen all over the place. Popular fuel, used it on the shuttle and everything. One good thing about the Dragon spacecraft, they don't use that. They might use a hydrogen peroxide type of system. There is some other kind of fuel they're using for thrusters, which makes it nice when it lands in the ocean or when eventually the Dragon comes back and lands on land. They won't have the problems every time the space shuttle landed, you saw people with like spaces on. I think Dragon has that. I know Dream Chaser definitely has the one that looks like the shuttle. They don't have the hydrazine fuel system. So maybe that has what you're talking about, John. Another good thing that Dream Chaser has, by the way, is the ablative tiles on the bottom. They just got to burn off when that shuttle thing comes back, and they're just going to replace it every flight by gigantic tiles instead of a million little tiles like the shuttle has. So it's a cheap replacement for their heat shield. A lot of things coming out. Back to Dick, WS1.
Thank you, Paul. I'm amazed how many companies are pursuing space launching of hardware, the equivalent, I guess, of the Russian supply ship. So, at first it seemed like we discontinued the space shuttle a little bit too soon, but maybe not. Maybe in the big picture it was the right thing to do economically. I thank you. John, why don't we try at least one of the mailbag questions tonight, even though it's kind of late. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech man.
KC2WGB, great information, Paul. Yeah, we can do that. I have one question from an elderly gentleman who is definitely staying up because he listens to the full name. That question we can cover. And he's interested in the directional coupler question, the dual directional coupler question from last week. So what he wants to do, let me let it drop. Okay, what he wants to do He has two Narda couplers, which are 20 dB. They're identical. And he wants to place them opposing. Will that give him a dual directional coupler?
Absolutely, yes. And he's caught on. In the case of a 20 dB directional coupler, 20 dB really means that the sampling port picks up a signal 20 decibel weaker than the signal flowing down the main line. 20% is 100-to-1 ratio. That means 1% of the power that flows through the main line of the directional coupler, 1% of it is being sucked off for the directional port. If you cascade a pair of directional couplers, one sensing the forward direction, one sensing the rear direction, and one right after the other, except for the 1% loss going through the first one by conservation of energy, there's got to be a minimum 1% loss going to the second one, which means, let's assume that the overall loss of the first one is, I'm going to pick a number, a tenth of a dB. So now, what you pick up with the second directional coupler, if the second directional coupler was the one in the forward direction, it wouldn't be a 20 dB coupler, it'd be a 20.2 dB coupler, because the first one that the signal has to flow through, it's got 2/10 of a dB of insertion loss. This is an easy, slight difference that you can mathematically correct for, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So as long as you're using relatively low-loss couplers, low-loss meaning well-constructed and 20 dB of coupling, if you were using 3 dB couplers, you'd be losing half your power going to the first one, going to the second one. And therefore, the second one, you think it's a 3 dB coupler, would really be a 6. But as long as you're using a high coupling decibel number, like 20 dB, there's nothing stopping you from casting 2, 3, 4 of them for various purposes. And some of the ones you cascade downrange could be favoring a different frequency region, and that's perfectly legal. So whether the two couplers are in the same package or cascaded between the two consecutive packages is a very minor difference. And once you understand how the thing works, where 99% of a signal, in theory, going through the first coupler is available to the second coupler, you could say safely the second coupler doesn't even know the first one is there. And so either one could be in either direction. And this is very close to one of the articles that I had on the Roadrunners Microwave Group. Let me drop it. There's a series of 10 articles that I recommend some people read by going to the k5rmg.org, www.kilo5roadrunnersmicrowavegroup, k5rmg.org. You go to that particular group from the North Texas Microwave Society, and you go to their main page, and you select technical articles. At the bottom of the technical article page, you'll find 10 articles by K2RIW. One of them tells you a lot of information about directional couplers. One of them tells you a lot of information about radio scattering because of antennas will scatter some signal. And the very first article on scattering, the scattering article, has really got three articles inside of it. And the first articles, one of them is setting up an experimental antenna testing facility, a Gedanken experiment, in which you've got this 1 mile diameter sphere in which you put 41,000 pieces of instrumentation on the surface of the sphere, and you've got a dipole in the middle of the sphere, and you're studying every micro inch of signal, so to speak, that comes out of the dipole. What are you going to see in the various directions, time delays, and so on? And what is that signal really going to look like if you constructed an animation from that signal? And that's the first place where I use these expanding bubbles. Let me drop. So the expanding bubble idea to explain a radio signal being propagated. I really was thinking along those lines way back in 2003, I think it was, when I wrote that article. The article set a date on it. I think it's roughly 2003. So some people have read those and really like them. They're not 100% accurate, but it gives you a certain way of thinking about radio waves. And so these expanding bubbles, I'm now convinced they don't require any push. That that signal you pick up by the second directional coupler doesn't require any pushing signal from the first directional coupler, if you know what I mean. And a directional coupler it's kind of hard to figure out why in the world it favors a signal in one direction and thoroughly reflects or rejects the signal flowing in the other direction. It doesn't. Let me drop. If you really study what a directional coupler is, and you can easily build one in the model match map management. In other words, what guys used to do to build a standing wave ratio bridge, they would take a piece of RG8 coaxial cable and remove the outer plastic black jacket. See, now you got the exposed braid. By crunching the braid together a little bit to loosen it up, they would be able to snake a piece of enameled wire, a couple of inches of enameled wire underneath the braid. And now the enameled wire is coming out of the braid in two different places, one further downrange than the other. That makes those two different places 4 inches apart, we'll say. That spare piece of enameled wire under the braid is a sampling device of the signal that flows on the piece of RG8 cable in either direction. An equal amount of it is being picked up by the enameled wire. It's in the near vicinity of the signal, and it's sampling some of that signal. And the signal coming out of the enameled wire, it comes out of the near end of the enameled wire when the signal flows up the cable. It comes out of the far end of the enameled wire when the signal flows down the cable. The enameled wire is picking up signal that flows in both directions. What your directional coupler does is take one of those directions and put a 50 ohm termination on it. So, and that termination is usually internal. So the signal that flows in the wrong direction is still being picked up by the wire. The wire itself doesn't have directional characteristics per se, but you terminate that particular port of the enameled wire in that example. So every directional coupler really is a dual directional coupler. And in some cases, they don't put that 50 ohm termination internally. They give you a fourth connector coming off the front panel, and you can put on the terminate repeater,
timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you can put on that termination yourself and decide whether or not it's a forward or reverse directional coupler or both. You put a crystal detector on each end, a 50 ohm crystal detector, and now you've got a dual directional coupler. So every coupler is really a dual directional coupler, but because of the ones you've got and they're nicely calibrated for your particular frequency region, put a pair of them in series. Works like a charm. And once again, remember, and this article on directional couplers on the Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5RMG, will tell you how to calibrate it, and the fact that the directional coupler, you may be using one that's rated from 1 to 2 gigahertz. And you want a directional coupler at 144 megahertz. You've got it. The 1 to 2 gigahertz directional coupler will behave beautifully in a very predictable manner down at 144 megacycles. It'll behave in a very predictable manner down at 50 megahertz. It'll behave in a very predictable manner down at 30 megahertz. It just becomes a 30, a 40, and a 50 dB coupler with a little bit of slant to it. Thoroughly predictable mathematically and easy to calibrate. So there's no black magic in that directional coupler once you get used to using them. And there are so few, there are so few articles explaining how a directional coupler works and what it is, that whenever I go to flea markets over the last 20 years, I always see a bench full of directional couplers. Nobody wants them. They originally were $1,500 a piece. The guy is selling them in pristine condition for $5 or $10, and everybody ignores them because they don't know what they are. They're very valuable piece of equipment, very inexpensive, thoroughly passive, and once you understand how to use it, a lot of fun to use. So it's time to get on board with these directional couplers, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, very good, Dick, yes. Very nice thing to have and a lot of fun playing with them. But to me, that question comes to me now that 2/10 of a dB loss when you add the second coupler because you've had that loss in the first coupler, does that apply to the dual directional self-contained coupler?
There's sort of a yes and a no to that one, John. It's a good question.
by the laws of conservation of energy, a directional coupler with a 20 dB coupling coefficient is sucking out 1% of its energy that's flowing through it on the directional port. Therefore, only 9/10 of, correction, 0.99 is left over. And if I take my calculator out and I take the log of 0.99 in a power manner, which means I take log multiplied by 10, where so there's the log in my machine, multiplied by 10, and the answer is 0.04 dB, 0.044. So 0.04 dB of loss in the first coupler is conservation of energy. Because the coupler really consists internally, in some cases, of a printed circuit board, in some cases, a piece of semiconductor, silver plated, suspended in air, going through a pair of type N connectors, one on the input end, one on the output end. For all practical purposes, a reasonable NADA directional coupler, 20 dB coupler, probably has a tenth of a dB of loss on the straight through line because of the connectors, whatever. Only 0.04 dB is because of the coupling. So your second coupler is getting a signal that's, in my example, a tenth of a dB weaker because it flows through the first coupler. That doesn't affect the directivity of the second coupler. It doesn't affect its coupling coefficient. You now can predict exactly what signal strength is applied to the second coupler downrange by subtracting the tenth of a dB, if that's what you measure as its insertion loss. Let me drop. And so the signal applied to the second one starts off a tenth of a dB weaker, and then the coupler is going to knock that down another 20 dB. But what comes out of the second directional coupler, if it's being used in the forward direction, is minus 20.1 dB, in my example. That's a very minor difference, because when you look at the real calibration chart alongside of a blue-cased, red-labeled, NADA brand directional coupler, quite a number of them will have a frequency chart along the side with a bunch of little punched dots telling you that it's rated as a 20 dB coupler, but it's got this curve of coupling coefficient versus frequency. If it's a 1 to 2 gig coupler, usually it's a slight bathtub-shaped curve where maybe it's going to be 20.2 dB of coupling in the center of the frequency range and 19.9 dB of coupling at the two ends or vice versa. You know what I mean? There's a slight curve. So if you're worried about the small amount of loss of the first one, you should worry first about the actual swept curve of coupling of the individual coupler. And there are precision, what's the word for it now? There are metrology-grade directional couplers that by a whole bunch of internal correction procedures, they can have a coupling coefficient that if it's rated to be 20 dB across the whole frequency range, it could be 20.0 dB plus or minus 0.05. But that requires a lot of extra work and a lot of extra money to get there. Over to you, John. KC2WJB, K2LIW, in the second half.
KC2WJB. Well, as you know, Dick, I've read your article several times, and one of the interesting things I found, and I think anybody who's interested in directional couplers should read about how important the geometry and how it works with the geometry. That I found fascinating. But I think Wes probably has a question, Dick, so if you want to go over, no problem. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Wes was on the original list. We should go there. And with all the time that's left over, we'll go to Lou. NQLU. I know Don Wells. We're going to have to get him to him next week. NQXJN. K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes. One more call. Wes, NQXJN, are you there? K2RIW.
Yes, I am. But it's switched properly. Do you hear me right now?
We're hearing you very well right now, so please proceed.
Okay. Well, one thing that I found a little bit as discomfort is that when we discussing some subject, we're going to one particular direction and then we're losing the overall picture. I would say when we were discussing the nuclear structure or the structure of something that is very obvious, ladies and gentlemen. When we have a standard model of an atom, we have a particle, and then we have an electron. But we know that each one of the fundamental particles has to have the counter particle, which then would be anti-particle comparing to the particle. So the electron will have a positron, proton will have anti-proton, neutron will be anti-neutron. And it's kind of, well, did we ever spoke about it? 3 years on the TechNet, did we ever said one single word? Let's say about positron. Let me just... So the positron is anti-particle of the electron. Our question is, we know how the extra electron works and that how it elevates to another orbit. Did we say one single word about positron? Or did we say any single word about antiproton? And yes, positron has a mass, which will be 9.1 times 10 to 31st, and antiproton will be 1.7 times 10 to 27. And neutron will have anti-neutron, which will be 1.7 to 10 times 27 as well. So, the positron is antiparticle to the electron, meaning that it has the same mass, but the opposite positive charge. In the standard model of the modern physics, every particle has an antiparticle, and the electron is most absent to it. How can we ever say the word about it? Like an electron, positrons are fundamental particles, means that they cannot be broken into the smaller parts. But there is one exemption for it. So the proton could be divided to quarks. Positrons are emitted by the radioactive sources through the beta decay. So basically, proton could be a positron could be a part of the energy or the energy manifestation by the atom. Anyhow, back to you, and I wonder if you have any comment on this, Dick, and to you.
Yes, I do. I'm not an expert in this area, but I'm going to tell you what I've concluded so far, what I know. And that is, one of the big mysteries in cosmology is that everyone believes that at the instant of the Big Bang, an equal amount of positive matter and an equal amount of negative matter was created. They really believe that. And either the negative matter went somewhere else, or the majority of positive and negative matter came together, annihilated each other, but there was a little bit left over, for whatever reason. You and I live in the positive matter universe. From our point of view, we call it positive matter. And in our natural world that we live in, there's an extremely small amount of negative matter. Very, very little of it. Maybe one molecule per billion is negative matter, and maybe it's not even that much. When you're doing high-power physics experiments in a particle accelerator, you're smashing things together. And some of those products do represent positrons, and negative protons and so on, antiprotons. You do get some of these other particles out of a high-energy physics experiment. Let me drop. And there are some materials that during their nuclear decay give you positron emission tomography, so to speak, PET. But these, except for some very exotic materials, are very rare events. What you and I live with day-to-day, as I see it, Wesley, is 99.99, maybe 100 more nines after it, all positive energy. Negative particles are extremely rare, except for those high-energy physics experiments and these exotic materials that happen to decay that way, which we rarely come in contact with, you and I. So for us to only discuss positive materials, when that's the vast majority of what we work with, see, touch, feel, measure, and so on, makes some sense. Since those negative matter particles in your and my world are so extremely rare, as a Gedanken experiment, we can discuss them. As a thought experiment, we can discuss them. But I think not very many of the experiments you do in your laboratory is going to involve negative energy. Let me drop. It'd be nice to believe that by some magic, you and I could get a hold of negative energy that the rest of the world can't easily get a hold of it, and now we can use it in our experiments to generate free energy. And boy, we could generate a whole lot of it if we had the right kind of equipment, and we could combine positive matter with negative matter. But since negative matter is so rare to you and I, it's so hard to get a hold of, that makes one of the main reasons I think we haven't discussed it. IntuXJN, T2LIW in the Tech Mask.
I wonder what Dan could say about it.
That's if Glenn is there. I just realized I didn't have the little button pushed in here where the speech processor is turned on. I don't know if Glenn is available. KC2QIQ, if you're there, Glenn, tell us what you feel about positrons and antiprotons. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, Dick, I'm definitely in agreement with most of what you're saying here, because like you just pointed out, most of the things that we talk about in ham radio and those discussions on the TechNet and the energy and frequency levels that we're working at, positrons and negative energy don't really come into much of the discussion because they're not really involved in the kinds of experiments that we do. So I think that's probably why they don't come up that way that often. So, if at all. What about back to you, the K2LIW.
Yeah, except for the things that you've read, Wes, let me throw the question back to you. In your experiments, how often have you used positrons or antineutrons or antiprotons? How often have you encountered them? You've read some articles on them. You've read some speculation as to a possible source of overunity and excess energy. But they're so hard to come by and so rare that it makes it kind of difficult to discuss from a reality point of view, from the point of view of a thought experiment, yes. But if you and I wanted to go out right now and get a hold of some antiprotons, boy, I think that would be difficult, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW.
For this, I would like to ask John to help me out. He said that 30 years ago, there was plenty of radioactive materials very cheaply available. Positrons are emitted by beta plus decay, which would convert the proton into the neutron and positron. We could say that one of the sources would be the isotope of sodium-22. I remember sodium-22 was one of the components of the generator that we discussed where the guy was charging only a very short period of time to have a few hours of use of the electricity, if you recall that, Dick.
Right now, I don't recall what you're talking about. So, are you saying one of the articles you had us read talked about a method of generating these antiparticles? Is that what you're saying, Wes? Go ahead.
Yeah. We had a discussion on the TechNet, and we analyzed the schematic about the guy who has made a supposedly over-unity device. It wasn't really over-unity device. It was the device that was using radioactive material, but the radioactive material was made out of the composition of regularly available materials. One of them was sodium. John, do you recall that?
Was that the one where there was a vial of material in this complicated structure and the
vial of material is supposedly undergoing a nuclear reaction. Is that the one that we discussed about 2 months ago, Wes? Go ahead.
That is correct. There was a very, very small glass tube, but half of an inch and long like 3 to 4 inches. And he put all of this material into it, and he was able to extract the energy of kilowatts out of it. But, John, do you recall that?
Yes, I do, Wes. I looked at that experiment. I don't recall what the claim was on it, but it was another one of those over-unity things. I do remember that.
What was the radioactive material was so easy to purchase quite a few years ago?
Yeah, let me think of it. Cobalt, I think it was.
Right, cobalt. So John said that the cobalt was so inexpensive, was almost everywhere, but right now it changed. I was thinking about revisiting that experiment. It sounds so easy to be done. John?
Yeah, the issue with cobalt was it was taken up by the medical field, and they sucked all of it up, plus it was dangerous. It was used to make cobalt glass and things like that, but it's very difficult to get a hold of now. You can get small samples, very small, about the size of a quarter with a dot of it on there, but that's about all I know about it. Dick?
Yeah, the fact that some of the isotopes of cobalt are radioactive and do spontaneous, natural, radioactive decay. If you're able to get a hold of that material, that is a kind of low-level nuclear reaction. It's natural decay process. But to take non-nuclear materials, radioactive materials, and put them into a flask, and class voltage between the materials, but the materials interact with each other at achievable temperatures and pressures that you and I can do in a laboratory, the chances of that creating a nuclear reaction is so extremely remote. So that's where I use that example. I know this is going to be repetitive, but some of the other people listening might get a kick out of this. And that is, if I just take a simple helium atom and I blow it up to the size of the Wembley Stadium in London, a stadium that is 1,000 feet in diameter. I blow up the whole atom so that the outer shell of electrons is 1,000 feet in diameter. The nucleus inside of that atom is approximately an eighth of an inch in diameter. The four protons and neutrons, the two protons, two neutrons, are the four nuclear objects are approximately 2 millimeters in diameter, an eighth of an inch in diameter, inside of a stadium of 1,000 feet diameter. 100,000-to-1 ratio between diameter of nucleus and diameter of atom. And now, in order to create a nuclear reaction, you have to fire high-speed nuclear-like bullets into that nucleus. You've got to hit that tiny little target, which is an eighth of an inch in diameter inside of a 1,000-foot diameter stadium. And if you take the usual spacing between atoms, you have a repeater, timeout, cancel. In this particular model, you're going to be flying your helicopter 1 mile above Wembley Stadium, and you're taking nucleuses that are 2 millimeters in diameter, and you're firing them into Wembley Stadium, and you want your nucleus being fired at near the speed of light to hit the nucleus of the atom that's in Wembley Stadium. Because of your accuracy requirements, if you shoot 1 billion bullets, there's only one chance in 10 that one of them is going to hit. So, as you can see, to make a nuclear reaction is so extremely difficult because the target is so small, the requirements of velocity and accuracy are so high, that unless you've got a large amount of material in what's called a critical mass, where now you've got so darn many molecules conglomerated together that no matter what direction you shoot one of these bullets at, so to speak, it's eventually going to hit something. Only if it's got a critical mass. So to make a nuclear reaction with a very small amount of material, with a chemical reaction, with pressure and temperature and voltage, to make a nuclear reaction under those conditions looks to me to be almost impossible, and now you know where I'm coming from when I say that. So I'm skeptical that this was a nuclear reaction unless you started off with materials that were naturally radioactive to begin with. N2XJM, KQRIW in the Tech Net.
Here's something interesting. We're going to read it. We use radioactive isotope sodium-22 because of its reasonable cost, long half-life, and high rate positron emission. Presence of an electron will often form an exotic atom called positronium. One way to visualize positronium is to consider the orbital model of the hydrogen where an electron travels around a much heavier proton. In contrast, the positronium would consist of an electron and a positron and a particle of equal mass, making positronium about 1,000 times less massive than hydrogen. While the small relative mass is very interesting, the most exciting feature of the positronium is the fact that it can spontaneously explode. Because positronium constituent particles are antiparticles of each other. Maybe that's what Iran is looking for. They're also worrying about sub-inhalating this stuff. And this is Educational Academic website. But here.
In the case of that helium nucleus that I just talked about, the helium atom, where you've got some two protons and two neutrons in the center, those two protons have got a lot of charge on them, and they have an extremely strong desire to repel each other. And there's something in the nucleus called the strong force that holds them together. By some kind of magic, the strong force does that. Now, this positronium, where you're speculating that you put a positron in the center as a nucleus and a electron going around it, and that this is a realistic material, positronium, has it really been seen? Does it really exist? I mean, that's a positron as a nucleus as opposed to a real proton in a hydrogen atom, would that really make a stable hydrogen-like atom? I'm a little worried about this one, though. How much positronium has ever really been seen, Wes? N2XJN, KQRIW?
I see this as a good material for the next segment because we have only 1 minute left and we're going to be disconnected because of LIMARC procedures. I'm going to send you the copy of this material. It was researched, it's real, and is existing. I do thank you very much for today's absolutely magnificent discussion with what's the atomic number of that product, Wes?
Hi, Dick. Thank you. See you next week. WHYY. Be kind to each other.